So, I don't know if you already think this, but it's something I think. I have one of the weirdest jobs in the world. I don't think it would be an exaggeration to say I'm not sure if you could find two people, even two people in the same church, who would agree on exactly what a pastor is and what a pastor should be doing. I remember one of my earliest experiences with this. Pastor Dave hired me right as we moved into this building. And then 6 months later, completely burnt out, he left. And we spent the next 11 months looking for another pastor. And that process was fascinating for me, a young Christian. I still remember some of the results of a survey that was sent out. We asked the question, what are the three most important skills or abilities that you expect to see in your pastor? And there were like 20 different things on the list. It was just check the top three, and things like preaching and vision casting and counseling and evangelism and on and on. And I'm not kidding. In a church of about 160 people at that time, almost every single skill of the 20 received basically the same number of votes. So that nearly 160 opinions of what our pastor should be and do were, you should be everything, right? If you think about it, to make everyone happy, like, we would have needed a pastor who was strong in all 20 areas. We would have needed to hire Jesus. When people outside of the church find out that I'm a pastor, I also get all sorts of interesting responses. Some with complete confusion. Have never heard of a pastor, and look at me like I'm speaking another language. One person asked me if pastors are basically spiritual life coaches. Many have no idea what a pastor is. Some have seen the scandals in the news. And so even if they couldn't tell you what a pastor is, they are pretty sure they know what pastors are, and it's not good. And so I have felt like like being an immediate suspect in people's eyes. It's all sort of a mess. What is a pastor? Nobody really has a definition. And because of this, I think I can wrap my mind around just a little bit. I can understand on a much smaller scale the story that the Gospel of Mark is telling us about Jesus, the Son of God. So if you have your Bibles, open with me to the Gospel of Mark, the very beginning, first chapter, first verse, where we read, "The beginning of the gospel of Jesus, Messiah, the Son of God." Mark is telling us right at the beginning that this is good news about Jesus, who is the Messiah and who is the Son of God. That the entire book, this entire gospel, is about this. When you read it, this is what you should be looking for. Every detail, every story, it's all there to explain and emphasize that Jesus is Messiah, the Son of God. There's only one problem, and it was a big problem in the ancient world. Son of God meant a lot of different things to a lot of different people, much like the word pastor does. The Roman emperor claimed he was a son of God. And even if you read your Hebrew Bible, you would have found that there were multiple sons of God. Spiritual beings were referred to as sons of God. The king of Israel, David himself, is referred to as a son of God. Even Israel as a community, as a collective whole, were called God's firstborn son. So when he comes along announcing the good news that Jesus is the Son of God, we're not quite sure what Mark means. And we should be asking the question, what does Mark mean by Son of God? Right? If only Mark would have given us a really clear and concise, like dictionary definition, that would have given us a good starting place, right? Or maybe Paul could have helped us out. He liked to explain things. or any other New Testament writers, it feels like it could have been really helpful if they had just written out in clear prose exactly what it means for Jesus to be the Son of God. I don't know how you became a Christian, but when it came time for me to pray a prayer, I was asked this question: do you believe Jesus is the Son of God? And in the same way that I kinda, sorta understood what I was committing to when I was making my wedding vows, I was like, yeah, I'm in. Jesus, Son of God, I'm good with that. But as much as I wish someone had given me a definition of Son of God to work with, I actually don't think it would have done much good, right? If God wanted us to have these kinds of clear definitions, he would have given us a dictionary rather than the Bible. Definitions, when we're talking about people, have the effect of shrinking them. There's a sense in which a definition can provide some clarity, and that can feel helpful, but our definitions are always too small, too limiting. So early on, I thought Son of God just meant Jesus is divine, that he is in some way God. And maybe you're thinking, right, how is that a small definition? Saying Jesus is divine is a pretty big claim. And maybe it is, especially today. But in the ancient world and throughout most of human history, people have believed in lots of gods, including humans who were said to be divine. So that actually wasn't that special. But these different gods that people believed in had all sorts of different characteristics. Most people believed that these gods had powers, and most of them did pretty terrible stuff. The early followers of Jesus didn't think Jesus was just a god like any of these others. They believed that there was something truly unique about him, something that set him apart among all others, which is why saying Jesus is divine is simply too small. They thought all of them were divine. Just for a second, consider personality tests and the way they shrink us. Whichever one is your favorite, and I actually like them to some degree, right? The Myers-Briggs or the Enneagram. Like, how many times have you felt smaller and unseen because someone defined you with a label or a number? You might not know this, but introverts can actually like people, but they are sometimes treated like they're these antisocial freaks. Introverts, right? Have you ever feel that way? And you may not know this, but extroverts, not me, other extroverts, can be painfully shy. Sometimes a category can help us understand the world, understand a group of people, individuals. It can help us make sense of people. But the moment we try to nail people down with a simple definition, we almost always leave people out or leave out massive, major components of who someone is. Do you believe Jesus is the Son of God? Whether you say yes or no might not be as important as, like, what do you think that even means? Will Willimon, a pastor and theologian, he taught for years at a college, this introductory class on Jesus. And he'd always start the semester the exact same way. He'd ask the class to describe God, and he'd rapidly write every answer up on the board that they would give in kind of rapid fire. God is omnipotent. God is omnipresent. God is omniscient. So, right, all powerful, ever present, all knowing. You'd get God is loving. God is just. God is mighty, and on and on. And then, right there in class, Willimon would have his students read the whole Gospel of Mark together. And some of them would bristle. I didn't pay for college to read the Bible. I could do that on my own. But he would ask at the end, what does Mark think God is like? Right? Read Mark. Listen to what Mark has to say about who God is. What does Mark think that God is like? And the class would struggle with the fact that Mark's stories don't really align well with many of our classic definitions of God. Jesus, the Son of God, crying out from the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Just doesn't really fit most of our definitions of God. And this really is the problem. Our clear and precise definitions of God are almost always going to be too small. Look at any statement of faith, and you'll read some beautiful descriptions of what God is like. But if you take that statement of faith and you say, this is God, I guarantee you, God is bigger. Our definitions of God will usually be so small, or at least too small, so that when Jesus actually shows up in our life and in the world, we either won't recognize him, or we'll crucify him. We didn't read this portion of Jesus' final days earlier, but if you have your Bibles and you turn to chapter 14, I want to read a piece that we skipped over. In verse 53, Jesus has been arrested and he's been dragged before the Jewish high priest and the elders and the scribes, and they began to question him, and he says nothing. And then in verse 61, the high priest asked Jesus, are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed? Notice how spiritual the high priest is. Like most Jews of his day, he avoided saying God's name. This was an act of reverence. It's like how in Matthew's gospel, the kingdom of God is referred to as the kingdom of heaven. Here, the high priest has very specific rules about how to honor God, and he has very specific definition of about who God is and what God can do, so that when Jesus responds, I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds in heaven, the high priest has no option but to freak out. In verse 63, the high priest tears his garments and declares that this is blasphemy. And together, the leaders, they condemn Jesus, the Son of God, to death. But, of course, right, if you've been reading Mark's story, this won't surprise you. Confronted by the high priest, asked if he's the Son of God, Jesus acknowledges that he is. But more than that, he ties this phrase to the phrase that he has been using all along the way as he's been traveling to Jerusalem throughout the gospel. Jesus is the Son of Man. He is the human one. At every point in the last several chapters, Jesus has been announcing that he's going to suffer and die in Jerusalem. You sort of like get the feeling, if you're not used to Jewish storytelling, you're like, okay, we get the point, because Mark keeps telling us that Jesus told his disciples that he was going to suffer and die, and on the third day he was going to rise. And you're like, okay, move on to the other things. What other kind of cool miracles did Jesus do? And Mark is saying, stop. This is the point. He would die a human death, and through it, he would set humanity free. He would restore humanity through his death. The high priest and his fellow leaders. They believe that they are going to kill a man who is claiming to be God. But the Gospel of Mark shows us a God who has become truly human to serve humanity and give his life as a ransom for many. What you intended for evil, I intended for good. We hear this phrase from Genesis echoing in the background. See, for Mark, the emphasis isn't actually on Jesus' divinity, although all along the way you see him doing all of the things that only God can do. But for Mark, that's actually a given, which is kind of mind-blowing. But if we follow what Mark is doing, he is concerned with what Jesus has come to do on behalf of the Father. If you want to know what God is like, listen to the Son. Look at his life and his death, and you will see God. Because Mark is saying the two are in perfect alignment. And I love the way that Mark tells this story. And I want to just run you through just some of the highlights, because it's a thread through the whole gospel that many of you, as you're doing this read through the New Testament, you've probably heard this, and I want to connect some of those dots. And it all starts where we started earlier in 1:1. Right? Mark tells us exactly what kind of story he has for us. He sets it up. This is the story. This is the good news of Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God. Okay, cool. What's that mean? Well, 11 verses later, we get this sneak peek that none of the disciples or John the Baptist or anyone else seems to get. Jesus is being baptized in the Jordan, and a voice from heaven speaks, and it seems that Jesus is the only one who hears this word. But the Father is confirming his identity and his calling. You are my beloved Son. With you, I am well pleased. So at this point, we the readers, the Father and Jesus seem to be the only ones in on the story, the secret. As readers, we've been told exactly who Jesus is, but Mark is going to tell this story, filling in all that it means. And I don't know if you've ever heard it this way, but it's actually a really funny story. So Jesus' closest friends, the people who are with him all the time, everywhere, every step of the way, they have no idea who he is. The religious leaders and the people who are like the most equipped to understand the ways of God, well, they can't understand who he is. It makes me think of this news clip that I watched this week of a helicopter news reporter who's reporting on a high-speed chase. And after the guy who was running crashes, the suspect gets out of his car and he's running away, and he turns down this alley and he dives behind this car, and the police come running and they like pass right by him. And it's like a Keystone Cops, like it's really silly as the police go running by in this almost cartoonish way because they can't see him. But the news reporter up in the helicopter, you can hear his commentary, and he's freaking out. He's yelling at the officers, who can't hear him because he's in a helicopter, going, he's right there. You guys, go back. Go. And they're just running off because they have no idea. As readers of Mark, we can feel like this news reporter yelling at the disciples, go back. He's over there. Don't you get it? Like, we know Jesus is God's son. Well, we've been told Jesus is God's son. But no one in the story can see it yet. Well, that's not entirely true, because the unclean spirits can see it. Chapter 3, verse 11, the unclean spirits see Jesus and they fall down and they cry out, you are the Son of God. Chapter 5, verse 7, an unclean spirit cries out, what have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? So the unclean spirits know exactly who Jesus is. While the disciples and everyone else struggles. And then it just gets funnier. Because in chapter 6, verse 3, Jesus goes to his hometown. Surely, if anyone will recognize Jesus and understand him and his mission, it would be his family and friends, right? Instead, they ask a question specifically designed to spark our attention as readers of Mark. Jesus isn't the Son of God. Instead, they already know who Jesus is the son of. So in 6:3, it says, is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and brother of James, and so on? And they took offense at him. They think they already know who he's the son of. Have you ever had one of those moments where you just had to sit someone down and you had to be very clear with them, right? Can you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth? That kind of talk. Jesus takes Peter, James, and John up a mountain for one of those talks. The same voice that speaks to Jesus at his baptism speaks to Peter, James, and John. Chapter 9, verse 7, we're told, a cloud overshadows them and a voice comes out of heaven. Do you understand? This is my beloved son. Listen to him. They're told. And I love this. God doesn't give them a definition. He just tells them, this is who Jesus is. Let's go. Right? He tells them exactly what it means. That he, whatever else they think is happening, is worthy of their trust. And that they should listen. That his words are good and where life is found. But then they walk back down the mountain and Mark tells us they're confused and they're questioning what just happened. Direct, this is who Jesus is. And they walk away. What was that? Chapter 12 then, Jesus actually tells the religious leaders as he's approaching his death a parable. And in this parable, he identifies himself as the son of the father. This is like the most explicit he ever gets. This is the first time in Mark where Jesus explicitly identifies himself in this way. And immediately, what's the response? They're ready to arrest him. They're just looking for a time to do it. They understand exactly what he is claiming. And then a couple chapters later, Jesus is arrested and he stands before the high priest. And we've already heard that account. And then, when he's presented to the crowd, he's presented with an alternative. Jesus, the Son of God, is presented in place of Barabbas, Bar, the Son, Abbas, the Father. Will you choose the Son of God or will you choose the Son of the Father? Can you tell the difference? Do you know what God has come to do? If you're presented with two people to follow, will you choose the one who lays down his life for all of humanity, or will you choose the criminal? Now, not everybody would have seen him as a criminal. He was a revolutionary. He was eager to fight Rome and to help the Jewish people reclaim their identity. It chose the Son of the Father. There's one last reference to the Son of God in Mark. We've hit them all. Consider this for a second before we get there, though. Up until this point, only the unclean spirits have confessed Jesus as the Son of God. The religious leaders couldn't recognize him as the Son of God. His hometown friends and family didn't recognize him as the Son of God. His disciples couldn't see. And even the three disciples who were explicitly told from a voice in heaven, this is my son, they've got nothing. And so Jesus is crucified. He is tortured and he is killed as a blasphemer. He's mocked and he's reviled for hours as he hangs on the cross. The God of the universe is crucified by the people who were made to bear his image. If you're following in your Bibles, turn to chapter 15, verse 37, for the final reference to the Son of God. Verse 37, and Jesus uttered a loud cry and he breathed his last. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." Let me tell you a beautiful truth about the Gospel of Mark. It gets funnier every time you read it. Two things happen as Jesus takes his final breath that are hilarious. The curtain in the temple, the veil, the important critical barrier that kept people out of the Holy of Holies, the most holy place where God himself dwelt. The presence of God was supposedly in that place. It is ripped open. And you know what's inside? Nothing. There's nothing in there. Israel's religious leaders had been fighting to preserve a religious system that had long been empty. God's presence wasn't in that little square room. If God wasn't in the Holy of Holies, where was he? He was hanging on the cross, hung there by the very people who thought they were defending him. The very people who thought he was in that room. Seriously, this is hilarious in a really tragic way, but also really funny. Like when you can sort of see the ways that we also walk in these same sorts of ways of thinking we have God figured out. And if that's not enough, Mark actually takes it one step further. Standing next to Jesus on the cross, watching Jesus die is a Gentile, a foreigner, an outsider, an enemy. And he is the one, the first one to see what no one else can see. No religious leader, no family member, or even disciple has been able to see it, that Jesus is the Son of God. How does he come to see it? Because of Jesus's death, we're told. That there's something about who Jesus was and the way that Jesus died that broke everything open for this Roman soldier, his heart and his eyes, and he saw what no one else could see. And the key, Mark is telling us, is the cross. What is God like? Who is the Son of God? Jesus on the cross. That is where we start. This is who God is. This is what God is like. And I ask you this morning, as you look at the cross, can you see the beauty of God giving his life for all of creation? Is God giving you the eyes of the centurion? There is something about this vision of Jesus that draws us, but there is something about the way that the world has shaped us and formed us that will keep us calling out for Barabbas. It's amazing that God just doesn't give us definitions, right? But I have great news for some of you who don't like failing tests. Like, there is no test where you'll have to perfectly define in short answer form what is the Son of God. Instead, God just gives us stories. Stories of the Son of God. And he invites us to keep writing new stories as we walk with Jesus, as we listen to him, and as we obey him. God has given us stories, and God has given us a meal. So that every time we eat and we drink together, we have the chance to see the Son of God in all his glory crucified, so that all might live, so that you might live.